Would you like some freshly roasted premium coffee? It's my only weakness. And it's easier than ever to give in to this weakness in Canada and the US with Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-caf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible and comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you're one of our American listeners, the wait is over. No longer are us Canadians hogging all the Sparkplug. It now delivers in Canada and the US. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
It's a brew. It's a brew.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, one and all, and thank you ever so much for listening to the next 187 Project, the Monday morning jibber-jabberoo about classic films. We spoil movies, tush tush. And we started doing that by reviewing each and every one of the AFI's great movies on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. In fact, the first film in this series was part of that collection, so that was Frankenstein. And go put an ear to that app as well as this one, because why not listen to them both back to back? Why not? You'll hear how we've progressed over the years. The audio is sure going to sound different. I'm the monster indeed who loves dead, hates living, tolerates everything in between. Sound more like Schwarzenegger there, don't I? Ryan Ellis. And here's the delightful bride of Ryanstein, my only weakness, my wife Bev.
That's me.
I have lots of weaknesses, but that is a recurring phrase, and a funny one in this one. All right, maybe you could tell, but we have a new audio setup again. This hopefully is the permanent setup. We both have a microphone in front of us. Finally, we're pseudo-professional, and now we can make moony eyes each other anytime we want to. So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Bride of Frankenstein. Bride was one of 15 movies. I thought it'd be fewer. That's why this was a question in the first place. But anyway, 15 movies to be nominated for AFI's Top 100 Laughs and the AFI's Top 100 Thrills. So of the other 14 films that were nominated for the Laughs and Thrills, how many were directed by the same person? Spoiler alert, it's a guy. Spoiler alert, it's a white guy.
Going to narrow it down some more here.
Feels spoiler like alert. It's a American white guy.
Okay. I'm not sure if this is right because I could only track down 13 when I did my hunt. But is it Zemeckis?
This didn't surprise me, actually. Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future are the two movies that he had. They were both laughs and thrills. And that makes sense. Those two films, if you know them, fit that bill. Arguably Buster Keaton with The General.
He's an uncredited director.
That's why. The other movie would be Steamboat Bill Jr. But he's not actually listed in the movie's credits, so it's really just Zemeckis. Like I said, I thought I'd find five or six of these, and I kept going through my list, and oh, God, there's another one. But I did so much work on this, I wasn't going to stop. This didn't surprise me, Fargo. I thought maybe the Coens might have more than just one. They've combined laughs and thrills before, but only Fargo was nominated for the two. Others like Ghostbusters also make sense. Pulp Fiction makes sense. Thought maybe Tarantino would have more than one, but I only saw Pulp Fiction. Smokey and the Bandit. And then older, lesser-known films like Gunga Din and two movies by Harold Lloyd, Safety Last and Speedy, but he didn't direct, I don't think, either of them. And then you could argue, oh, Frankenstein, the first one, wasn't really funny. But a lot of James Whale's films were kind of hilarious. This one wasn't laugh-out-loud hilarious. And like I think I mentioned last week leading to this, he laughed at his films, at least this one, when he was watching it and somebody was pissed off. Stop laughing at your movie! But I think, like Hitchcock, Scorsese, and other directors, he thinks everything he makes, especially Hitchcock, is really funny. Hitchcock thought Psycho was a comedy, so that's how messed up he was. And clearly James Whale had a lot of fun with this, what ostensibly is a horror film.
Is Charade a Hitchcock film?
No, it's Stanley Donen. Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn are the stars, but Stanley Donen directed it. And nothing made both lists, though.
I bet if they made the lists again now, there would be more than one Lord and Miller film. They're both funny and thrilling.
22 Jump Street.
Well, that would be funny. I don't think they would put it on the thrills, even though it's a very thrilling movie.
There's a thrilling ending.
But
something
certainly
cool.
Into the Spider-Verse is both hysterically funny and a great action film. Oh, yeah, you're right. They didn't get directing credit. There's another good choice. Oh, I was thinking Lego Movie, but that would be laughs, maybe not thrills. And again, they didn't actually direct that, did they? They just wrote it?
They did Lego Movie.
God damn it, I'm an idiot. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay, we're going to move on.
I don't know
why
I'm on this podcast.
Into the body of the podcast, short little 75-minute movie, Bride of Frankenstein, which was released by Universal 85 years ago in April 1935. It was a success, but did go over budget. So good thing it succeeded, or else they would have been pretty mad at him for making a movie that cost too much. All right, Bev, remind people what this 85-year-old classic horror slash comedy is about with this gonna...
When we last saw Dr. Frankenstein, his monster was killed by a mob of angry townspeople in a windmill fire, but psych! The creature survived, and they're both up to their old tricks. The monster flails about looking for a place in this world and leaving a trail of bodies in his wake, while Dr. Frankenstein is convinced by his creepy mentor, Dr. Pretorius, to solve his monster problem with more monsters. The result? Turns out even monsters hate monsters.
At the end of the first movie, which I watched again on YouTube before we recorded here, Henry is thrown by the monster onto the windmill blade. Should be broken ribs at least. Maybe survive. Should be badly hurt. And they use a dummy to do that, but it's still kind of horrifying. We talked on that podcast all those years ago about how it wasn't scary. 1931 audiences and 1935 audiences with this. I think we're scared by a lot of things in this. Apparently the sound of earth hitting the coffin in the first one was horrifying to them. So anyway, that was a moment where you think, well, Henry's probably not long for this world, but then here he is in the sequel and continues on.
He has to be nursed back to health by Elizabeth. It is a plot point that he's quite injured and it takes a long time for him to get back up to speed.
They want to make a sequel. That wasn't something that was common back then, but the Universal monsters, they did have multiples, especially the Frankenstein character. I think it had more sequels than any of the other ones. There weren't a lot of Draculas with Bela Lugosi, at least I'm aware of, but there were 5 canon Frankenstein movies, but also some silent ones, more short films, before this one even. Or sorry, before the 1931 Frankenstein. All right, well, in a nutshell, it didn't happen in the first movie, so now I demand to know, where's my zombie sex? He now has a bride, although she rejects him awfully fast. But this man does have a large Wanfenstucken, as we find out in Young Frankenstein. So where's my zombie sex? Because this is the original zombie, I would say. The Frankenstein story from the book that Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley wrote. And then, like I said, the shorts that they did. And then the 1931 version.
The original zombie story is the Bible.
That's true.
I don't mean that, guys.
That's a good
just
point,
making
though.
A dumb joke.
That's a very fair point, yes. Okay, some numbers first. Rotten Tomatoes, 100% of critics liked Bride of Frankenstein. 44 fresh. 0 rotten, for an average of 9.1 out of 10. Wow. And 87% of audiences. It was nominated for its sound at the Oscars, but nothing for the cinematography or the sets, huh? Would have been worthy.
Oh, yeah.
But horror films back then, and now for that matter, are rarely, if ever, nominated for Oscars, and certainly don't win them very often. If Get Out is technically a horror film, it won for its script. Silence of the Lambs, Jaws, we've said before, are they horror films? Maybe, maybe not. The AFI list only had 4, or maybe 5, you could argue, at all are horror films. Psycho, Frankenstein, maybe Jaws, maybe Silence of the Lambs, and Sixth Sense. So 3 definites and 2 maybe horror films out of 123 they had in their list. And a lot of people would say, and I might agree with them, that this is better than the first Frankenstein.
Universally across the board, this was described as the first sequel that was better than the original, and overwhelmingly, it was described as better than the original Frankenstein.
This version made the National Film Registry in 1998. Easy Rider, The Last Picture Show, and Tootsie, all AFI movies we've covered, were in that same year. James Whale has 4 movies preserved by Congress, actually. The 2 Frankensteins, The Invisible Man, and then Showboat, which he directed after this. Not at all horror. I believe that's where Old Man River comes from. I'm sure that song precedes the movie, or predates the movie, but it's in that film, I'm pretty sure. And this movie was also nominated, including for the laughs and the thrills, we've already talked about that, for the top 25 music scores, which I bet you won't agree with, and the top 100 quotes. And because it's hard to find these things anymore as to what that actually is, if you didn't write it down somewhere, because the AFI, like the Box Office Mojo people, change things for the worse, I'm not really sure what that quote was, but it was nominated for that. Okay then, so, Bride of Frankenstein, your first time seeing it, I believe, right?
Yeah.
What did you think of BOF?
So first, respect to any film that keeps it under 90 minutes. plus a sequel with a neat recap off the top, I approve. I found it incredibly modern for an 85-year-old film. There were a few touches that I think were supposed to maybe play for comedy, which just didn't do it for me, like them thinking of that weird scene with all the weird miniature people. Otherwise, it's a miracle in tone management and story economy. Plus, the addition of the delicious Dr. Pretorius as our villain absolutely elevates the film.
Well, the point of the trivia question about laughs and thrills is exactly that. James Whale finds a way to manage to make this satirical, but also horrifying. It hasn't aged that well to make it truly scary to us or truly funny. We didn't laugh out loud at probably anything, but I can see why people would back in the day. We've talked about this in other podcasts, though, that comedy, the old ones at least, with some exceptions, don't really make us laugh. I think The Lady Eve is still really funny. I think you agree with that. His Girl Friday has a lot of good laughs in it. And some other films from this era, the 30s and 40s. But generally, those movies are more like, rather than guffawing laughter.
There's movies that are amusing. Mm-hmm. And then there's movies that genuinely make you involuntarily laugh.
And their idea of horror is fine, but doesn't really scare us anymore.
No. I have a kind of high threshold for horror, but this is barely scary.
You were fine to sleep that night. I had to go to work, and you didn't even think twice about the fact that you were going to be alone. Well, the dogs could protect you from the hissing Bride of Frankenstein. That's also something in the sequel that messes with the original, because the purists will say, the monster's not Frankenstein. The monster, or even the creature, is different than Frankenstein. The guy is Frankenstein. But even Dr. Pretorius says in that famous scene, the Bride of Frankenstein. Well, she's clearly not the bride of the Colin Clive character. He's saying she's the bride of the Boris Karloff character. So they mix and match within their own movie as to what is Frankenstein. And then again, as we know it now, look at Frankenberry, the cereal. That's not the Colin Clive guy. It's the Boris Karloff guy.
You talk about the monster Frankenstein. Everybody thinks of the monster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so before the story gets going, though, we get this unconnected opening. We don't see them later on. It's not like they close the story. And that's Lord Byron, real person, of course. Percy Shelley, real person. And Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, as they're just relaying the story. And the guy playing Lord Byron, Gavin Gordon, I can't do it, but rolling his R's on that opening. He's pretty arch. Apparently that opening was supposed to be a lot lustier. And this is James Whale for you. Very kinky guy. He wanted a lot more suggestions of it being kinky, as if the three of them are mixing and matching in the boudoir. But the censor said, no way, and that's not going to happen. It doesn't really matter anyway, unless that scene is supposed to be a lot longer. I think there were quite a few cuts to this movie, though. The first one was short. I think maybe 70 minutes. This one's 5 minutes longer. But either way, that's really short. Okay, so the first movie's happy ending is erased because Henry is still at the windmill in this version. But in the original, he gets badly hurt, taken back, nursed to health. And you hear the Baron, his father, saying, there'll be a grandchild, Frankenstein, something like that, implying that everything's going to work out. And the Baron's not in this movie at all. They do say at one point that Henry is the Baron without ever showing the guy who played him in the first movie or even recasting that guy. He's just not in the movie, and then Henry is supposed to be the guy in charge. Henry ain't no hero, and he ain't no victim. He's played by Colin Clive to be skittish and nervous and all these other things, but he is the villain of this. He sicks this creature on the people just because of his own hubris and that it's alive, it's alive. Now I know what it feels like to be God. That line that was cut from the original version. The funny thing about cutting that line is that that's the point. This guy is such an asshole. You cut it out and you really lessen the impact of that. But that was the way the censors worked back then. But now that we've seen this twice, this guy belongs in an asylum or behind bars or something. He's had two happy endings and he deserved zero happy endings. Fuck Henry Frankenstein and the way he keeps on doing this stuff. Even in the movie, I'm going to try and make more life. Then Dr. Pretorius comes in. I don't want to do that. You should. Okay, I'll do that. Somebody just breathes on him. Okay, I've changed my mind.
Dr. Pretorius doesn't really have to try that hard to convince him. At the beginning of the film, he's like, I will never. That was a mistake. I made a huge mistake. And then Pretorius is like, come on. Okay. Yeah, okay. Let's make some more life. And it's as though he can't help himself, as if he's upset by his own instincts that he can't resist to create more life, to create another monster. Pretorius feels no such scruples, and he's a villain, sure. But yeah, Frankenstein having a happy ending, it didn't sit well in the first film, and it doesn't sit well in this film. If I recall how the book ends, he is alive at the end of the book, but he has basically devoted his life to hunting down the monster
and
killing
it. They end up in the Arctic or something like
that. Yeah, and he watches him sink into the water. He goes off on an ice floe and he sees him drown or something. And then he's like, okay, finally it's over. And that's, I think, how the book ends. that he's alive, but he can only be redeemed because he destroyed the creature that he created. Whereas here, he doesn't have to do anything to be redeemed. He just has to have a woman vouch for him.
But then you look at things like sentience. People bring this up all the time now about the droids in Star Wars, for example, and they're being tortured in certain scenes. They're not just a toaster that talks. They are almost beings, like human beings in a way. They're not, but they are close to being that. Wally is a robot, but with such humanity. The creature, the monster, Bride of Frankenstein.
Actually,
the
I first think it's a great comparison between AI, something created by man, but that ultimately has feelings and sentience, with a zombie.
So do we have the right to just treat them as if they're just a piece of furniture?
And that is a question and a half.
I guess it's kind of like that Bill Cosby line, I brought you into this world and I'll take you out. And look at the villain he became. So do you agree with me that Henry Frankenstein should be in the pantheon of villains, more so, far more so, than his creature, who is thought of as one of the great monsters of the Universal era with Dracula, the Invisible Man, the Wolfman?
Yeah, absolutely. If somebody traps a bear and sticks it loose in the city, you don't get mad at the bear. The bear is the innocent creature that was set loose to harm people in a crowd. And it's the same with the monster. You don't blame the monster. He couldn't have necessarily predicted that the monster would lash out the way that he did. Although there's certainly reasons to call into question why he had to make his very first zombie be massive. You could have, I don't know, started with a smaller person. Start with a woman. Somebody weaker that's less likely to be able to drown children.
Blame Mary Shelley. Although maybe her story, I don't think I've ever read it, was just a normal-sized person. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember that detail.
The Kenneth Branagh movie in 1994, it was Robert De Niro plays the creature, the monster, whatever.
And
De Niro's barely
guy.
Bigger, if not smaller, than Branagh. They're about the same size in any case. So Karloff, again, is playing, and he's just billed as Karloff, not even as Boris. He was apparently that big a star, which maybe he was. I don't know. He and Lugosi really did take off after 1931 when they did Frankenstein and Dracula. But he plays Frankenstein for the second time, and I think he only played him one more time in total. Didn't for a while there, despite all the other spin-offs and sequels and things. He dislocated his hip in the windmill scene, they said, which I think probably helped his performance because he's supposed to have this shamble walk in the first place. But then he does evolve in this film, learns how to speak when he hangs out with the hermit, which, of course, another subtextual thing, which I'm sure Whale thought was hilarious because a lot of people pointed this out. Maybe it was noticed even back then, but certainly since, that this seems to be the subtext, if not text, for a gay relationship.
People go back and forth. They disagree. You have these two men happily sharing domesticity. Nothing wrong with their relationship. Nothing untoward going on there. And then it's ruined by two total strangers who just witness them living together.
One of whom is John Carradine, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And just destroy it. It's none of their business. These aren't people they know. They aren't hurting anybody. And they just take it upon themselves to destroy the relationship these two men enjoy. Yeah, that could be a queer thing.
But the monster had been doing bad things before.
Yeah, that's fair. Plus, he's obviously a monster. Mm. You just look at him and you're like, something's
the subtext
off right here.
Before.
But then,
that,
of course, if you were gay in the 30s, you probably were treated like a monster and you would be trying to find your place and everybody would be disgusted by you no matter what you did, just by your very nature.
James Whale is one of the few people in that era who was out.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, he created the character of Pretorius for this movie. Pretorius obviously reads as gay, what they used to call, he was sissified, and he was like a queer villain, a very common thing.
Very flamboyant.
For a very long time, for Hollywood to queerify their villains, to give the audience a shorthand of, you don't like this person, there's something wrong with them.
We covered Laura a couple years ago, great example there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The villain of that film, who actually idolizes Laura and seems to lust after her. But the character seems to be gay, and I think the
it's
actor
so
was
confusing to watch it. Laura, I'm talking about from a 2020 point of view. I don't understand. He's obsessed with her, but he's clearly a homosexual. Mm. So what is this obsession even? Because it seems really romantic. And I wonder if it's just that the studios were like, oh, well, if he's the villain, sissify him.
George Saunders in All About Eve comes across that way, too. Is his name George? I think I have that name right.
He
the one
has
who won
other
the
things to gain, though, other than a relationship with Eve.
And yeah, but the way he comes across is that he's not sleeping with her when they do get together. He just wants to dominate her. And I don't remember if the actor was gay, but the way it's played, it's more macho than most, would you call it, sissification characters?
Yeah, Reeves
but still,
is gay,
he comes across that way a decent amount. And that's also getting out of this era, of course, 1950, compared to this is 1935.
But speaking of Pretorius reading as gay, is it an intentional thing then that when he comes and he tries to lure Henry back into this life, Henry just can't seem to resist him? And even though his lovely wife, who's just nursed him back to health, is begging him not to, he is compelled to go with Pretorius.
The Top Gun thing. Go the gay way. Come on, you can ride my tail, man. No, he can ride mine.
But if he is also gay, then no matter how lovely his wife is, he's always going to be lured back into a relationship like this that's just going to be the kind that feels right to him, no matter how much it turns him into a villain and a monster of his own kind.
That's probably the subtext then from James Whale.
Yeah, well, this is all debatable. Historians have gone back and forth, and apparently James Whale himself said that he always saw his art separate from his life and he never really wanted to add queer subtext to his films.
Yeah, but the Frankenstein monsters, both of them in this movie, The Invisible Man, another one, being shunned from society for being a little bit different. Well, a lot different in the case of The Invisible Man and the creatures in these movies.
And I think in both cases, by no fault of their own.
Yes.
In Frankenstein, he was literally born that way.
Life out of these movies. If they ever remake Bride of Frankenstein, and they maybe should, because they've done Frankenstein or I, Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein, all the rest of these over and over and over. But if they ever do Bride again, then they have to cast Ian McKellen as Dr. Pretorius. He even looks like him.
Yeah, you're right.
And of course, he's actually gay, but I'm just saying that he's a great actor. He could definitely do the flamboyant over the top thing. Not to criticize McKellen or pigeonhole him just because he is gay, but I just think he literally looks like the guy. So you have that right there. And he's got that old Englishman look, even more so now that he is getting way up there in age.
Now, I don't remember if Pretorius was a character in the Kenneth Branagh Frankenstein, but there was a bride. Helena Bonham Carter is the bride.
But the human bride, not the...
No, she's dead and they bring her back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. She's living and then they bring her back. She looks just as gruesome as Frankenstein does. Oh. Almost worse in a way. Her hair's all burned off.
Oh, wow.
And then she kills herself rather than be with the monster.
Which kind of happens in this movie. Well, the monster is the one that does it to all of them. But she rejects him instantly when he's, oh, friend, oh. No! Fine, fuck you, bitch! I'll kill us all.
Love her performance. It's so funny that she's only in the movie for 5 minutes, but no wonder it's such an iconic character because she just puts so much life into that 5 minutes on screen.
Where her head moves about like a chicken.
Well, she technically has more than 5 minutes on screen because the same actress plays Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley at the
Elsa
top
Lanchester.
Of the film. Yeah.
You can see it on the IMDb. She's the monster's mate and then Mary Shelley. She was married to Charles Laughton, who as I believe was... maybe not so closeted, but he was gay too. I think I read that somewhere.
I read that they were married, and I was like, I really thought Lawton was gay, but maybe I have it wrong.
Maybe it wasn't so much a front. Maybe it's just a matter of it being a financial thing, or she just loved him and said, I'll marry you anyway. I don't know.
Probably a lot of gay people got married back then.
Could have been bisexual, I guess, too. But she is pretty effective in that little role. It's been brought up before. There's no way all that hair could fit in the bandages you see early on. Although, then again, when you see people that wear wigs in movies and they take them off, some of them seem to have a lot of hair underneath there.
No, but the idea is that it's a lightning bolt that makes her hair go like that. It's supposed to look like Nefertiti. That's why it's shaped like that.
Okay, and then Marge Simpson has the same kind of hairstyle. And also in Gods and Monsters, great connection to this movie. I like the point that's made by the actor who plays Ernest Thesiger, who says to James Whale, of course that's McKellen. So McKellen did play somebody in these storylines. Maybe that's why I thought of it as well. But he does look like Thesiger. They bring up in that movie, did the guys take time to dress the bride? Are Colin and I to have dressed her, James, Jimmy?
That's his favorite part. Actually, it kind of is appropriate when you think about the fact that Thesiger, or I should say Pretorius, has all these little human dolls that he's created, and he's not just dressed them, but given them personalities and characters as the king and the queen and all kinds of other stuff going on. So why wouldn't he also dress the bride?
All right. Yeah, he's big into the dressing part of it. The real achievement in these movies, by the way, and this one especially, as impressive as it is to recreate life, are those little creatures. Because the monster, in this movie, yes, does learn to speak, but in the first one does not. He's just this infant, this newborn, who's in a man's body wandering around, trying not to do bad things, but does accidentally. The bride doesn't have much of a chance to live, but probably would have been the same. But Pretorius's little creations, the little creatures, people, I guess, and the bell jars seem to have actual personalities. They're yipping at each other, and they seem like just regular people that are small. They shot that, by the way, pretty impressive for 1935, the visual effects. But they shot that in front of a black velvet screen, and then they just shrunk them down and post-production kind of thing. It's pretty cool stuff,
actually. Looks really good. They're actually very seamless-looking effects.
But I think it's more impressive what he did than what Frankenstein
did. That's part of what makes that scene stand out so much is that, why are you going to Frankenstein for help? Look what you did.
You're going to the minor leagues when you're already in the major leagues.
Yeah, he can't do anything like what you can do. Frankenstein is a disaster. These are going around murdering people. And like you said, they have some sophisticated intelligence. They don't look like zombies. That one scene in particular, I was just like, what are they thinking? Is this just supposed to be a goofy little interlude to entertain us?
I guess to show that Pretorius is qualified to talk to somebody about this kind of deal because he's also done something so impressive.
Who would want to do that? I'm going to create a miniature mermaid. And they all live in these itty-bitty pint glasses.
Well, could you argue that he just set them up in there to present them and then he puts them in some aquarium or something like that when all is normal?
It's a miserable life.
It is a weird sequence. Maybe it's just supposed to be hilarious. I suppose it's possible that Whale laughed his ass off at that when he watched the movie. One of the more memorable characters in this movie is Una O'Connor's Minnie, because she gets to say, "It's alive," then "He's alive." The "He's alive" refers to Henry, because they do find him and they retcon this because he shouldn't be at the mill according to the first movie, but he still is at the mill, which was burning too. In watching their sequence at the end all over again, the monster gets trapped under a beam and is clearly not getting out of there, and the mill is already seriously on fire. And if he were to get out, the villagers would just surround him and beat him to death, probably, because they're so mad at him. There's a lot of vigilante justice in these movies, these first two anyway, probably all the Frankenstein movies, I'm guessing, and the various remakes. Well, they do show that in Young Frankenstein. There's a lot of parodies about a lot of things, including the vigilante justice.
Yeah, okay, but the monster's killed a lot of people, and he kills a lot more in this movie.
But if you believe in justice, then capture him, which they do briefly, but he gets out almost instantly. But keep him captured and put him on trial.
Okay, well, they tried that. It didn't work.
He's out almost instantly. Well, another person who's out almost instantly is when Elizabeth is captured later on. And I don't know why they didn't redo this. It's weird. James Whale was a pretty good director. I like his work generally. But this is awfully sloppy. She pulls her left hand out of the straps holding her down, the ropes holding her down. And the actress Valerie Hobson realizes right away, oh no, I got to put that back in there. So she slips her hand back behind her back when she clearly just got it out of the ropes.
Maybe the actress just failed to call anybody's attention to it. And nobody noticed when they were on set. And then it was too late by the time
I don't know how you don't
realize
that.
Because you're paying attention to something else in the scene.
There's only her and Carl. Same actor, Dwight Fry, who played Fritz in the first Frankenstein, and Renfield in Dracula. And we haven't even had Igor yet. Eventually, Igor becomes the assistant in the series. And, of course, Igor in Young Frankenstein. He literally killed a woman, though. We don't see it happen, but you know that's what he's about to do. A woman's walking down the street, minding her own business. Next thing we know, he's got body parts for them. It wasn't like they found a dead body like in the first movie. He murdered somebody to make the body for Bride of Frankenstein.
Villain.
Another villain. A lot of villains in this movie, and it's not the Karloff or Lanchester characters. It's the other people who are the villains. We talked a little bit about the hermit and the monster scene. Let's get back into that a little bit more because it is one of the more famous scenes in this movie. The monster is taught to speak by the hermit, so presumably he lives with them for a little while. It looks like it might be a day or two, but I think it's supposed to be longer considering the monster actually knows how to talk, and it wouldn't take a day to do that. It would take longer. This is one of the best scenes in Young Frankenstein, though, where Gene Hackman plays him. Gene Hackman wasn't known for comedy, except when Gene Hackman did comedy.
Royal Tenenbaums.
Get Shorty in Royal Tenenbaums. He's really funny. And in Young Frankenstein, they have the same basic scenes. He teaches him about smoking. And of course, the creature doesn't like fire, so at first he's afraid. Teaches him about drinking wine, music, all these other things. But then, as we mentioned, John Carradine from Grapes of Wrath and many other movies, he was involved eventually in the, I guess, Dracula films or something. He played many villains over the years.
And of course, he's David Carradine's father.
So what do you think of O.P. Heggie and Boris Karloff in that scene? We already talked about the gay subtext, but just the way the scene plays out. It's actually pretty sweet, but it's funny too because the monster's violent. Then he wants to learn things and friend. But as soon as, and understandably, he's pissed off that these guys roust him out of that house, the hunters do, then he's violent again. But then he wants friends again, but then he's violent again.
Okay, so the key is that you have to look at the monster as if he's a newborn, right? So he has the body of a man. If you put the brain of a toddler in the body of a man, they would kill people too because they just don't have the capacity to understand how not to do that. And you have a temper tantrum and you don't understand the consequences of your actions. So because the hermit is kind to him and teaches him, which is what he wants, gives him a little place in this world, he's gentle with him. He doesn't feel the need to have a tantrum and hurt anybody. He's dangerous, yes, but it's mostly because they were foolish enough to put him in this circumstance in the first place. I like those scenes. I think it is the proof that under the right circumstances, the monster should deserve to have a life and be treated properly so that he wouldn't have these violent impulses. And there's quite a bit of Christ-like imagery. That's part of why I made the joke earlier about how the Bible's the first zombie story. Well, there is Christ-like imagery in this. I say that because the hermit gives him bread and wine. When he's arrested by the townspeople, he's crucified. I think his hands are a little bit up, but it certainly is a very Christ-like imagery. Any film, any piece of
work
that...
Hold on, one thing. He's also Jewish. Stein. Frankenstein.
Oh my God, that's so true.
Frankenberg. Frankenman. Bergsteinman.
See, it's all adding up. What was the last one? Oh, just that he's resurrected. He gets resurrected first and then crucified.
He's resurrected multiple times in a way, because the one who was hung in the first movie becomes the creature for most of that first movie. And then it's implied that he doesn't survive the windmill scene. But you want a sequel, so of course he does survive. But that means in a way he's resurrected. He didn't literally die, I guess you'd argue. He somehow survived as the windmill collapsed into the water. Okay, fine, we'll cut you that slack. But in a way, in a story way, for sure, he's resurrected. And then the character comes back after this movie, so he's resurrected yet again. Because at the end of this, he's the one that pulls the switch, saying for some reason to Henry Frankenstein, go, you live. The one who should absolutely die more than anyone else in there.
Well, he's not going to die because there's a lot of franchise money riding on him.
And, well, he being the actual creature, not Henry.
Henry, too, because you have to have Henry for sequels.
I don't think Colin Clive ever played this character again. He didn't live too much longer.
No, but you could, of course, kill Henry and write around it. They killed Frankenstein and wrote around it. But well, if these keep making money, we'll just keep making them.
But the monster is the more famous one of the two of them. It's not like every single version of Frankenstein's always had Henry, but everyone, I think. Sometimes he's called Victor, but I think every
in
other
the book,
one.
He's Victor, I think.
But in every single version of the story, of course, you've got the Boris Karloff, well, not always Karloff, of course, but the monster that Karloff made famous.
Are there Frankenstein sequels that have no scientist at all?
I'm thinking so.
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly, but like I said, there's a ton of things like Aaron Eckhart in I, Frankenstein. I don't remember much about it, but I think it might just be him as the monster. And then even spinoffs like Reanimator, which definitely has a doctor. Spinoffs, but homages, I should say, or other versions of it. And of course, we've talked about this when we did Edward Scissorhands, where that's clearly a Frankenstein story. But at the very end, Henry is still in the castle, and you see him up against the wall during the explosions. And the filmmakers knew this would be a continuity problem when he's outside hugging Elizabeth. Oh, I'll survive again. I deserve to live. No, you don't. But I'll survive, even though he's inside. But they wanted it to be a happy ending, like the first movie had a happy ending. Even though, like I said, at the end of that movie, he should have been dead from the really vicious fall he takes onto a windmill blade.
I'm surprised the censors let him get away. He's clearly a villain. He's playing God. You think that killing him would satisfy the censors?
Yeah, the censors don't always come down hard on... What was it we just talked about this recently where there was something that... Pinocchio.
Oh, it was everybody in Pinocchio.
Yeah. Were the bad guys in that? Nobody's punished. You can't blame the whale. Monstro shouldn't be punished. But Stromboli doesn't get punished in any kind of real way. Neither
do
Honest John
and the cat.
The fox, yeah.
Yeah.
Nor the coachman.
Yeah, the coachman. Good Lord, he's an evil guy. None of the adults in Pinocchio get punished.
Censors picked and choose when they want to be on top of things and really solve the problems, make everything right in the world. I said near the intro about how this movie could have been, maybe even should have been nominated for the cinematography and the sets on top of being nominated for the sound as it was. I love the backdrops, which I think they use even when they're supposed to be outside, but clearly they seem to be on a set, but I think that works pretty well anyway. The cinematographer John Mescal shot 91 films, including Showboat for Whale. Editor Ted Kent cut Ghost of Frankenstein and The Road Back, which was a failure for Whale. Didn't end his career, but didn't help his career. And then the music, which I'm sure he didn't like, Franz Waxman, who we've covered before, he won Oscars for Sunset Boulevard and The Place in the Sun back-to-back and did a lot of early Hitchcock films before Hitchcock found Bernard Herrmann. Waxman's music is big and over the top, nominated for the AFI Top 25 Music Scores. I'm guessing you didn't love it, but what did you think about
the
look?
That. Okay, I didn't mind the music.
Okay.
I did
you
it.
You have cut the slack for the horror films when they've had
Yeah, there's certain films where it's just more appropriate and necessary to have big bombastic music. And it didn't bother me. I think I'm probably a little more forgiving always of older films. And it didn't stand out to me, which is always good. The score always just seemed to fit and feel appropriate, and it wasn't just like some dumb wall-to-wall music.
One of the Universal horror characters we haven't talked about yet, he was a little bit later on, but he does fit in that whole lexicon, is the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And it's a good theme, but you watch that movie, which is not very long either, and it plays, I don't know, 512 times. Dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun.
I'm even thinking of the score for Gone with the Wind. I know it's a totally different kind of movie, but I hated that score, and it was just really blanketed. It's not like the composers were like, oh, let's place the music in certain places because we want to up the emotional ante and aid people to feel the right things. It was just like, oh, well, every single frame of this film has to have some kind of music, right? I didn't feel that about Frankenstein. So many things about this movie are so innovative and modern, and it's really easy to forget that it was made in 1935. You compare this to all the other films we've watched from that time, and it really does stand head and shoulders above them, so you have to give it credit. It must have been a tremendously influential film in all kinds of ways. People credit this movie with inventing camp.
John Waters must love this.
Oh, my God. And you know what else made me think a lot about Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Yeah.
In the tone, not obviously in the theme that he does create a monster in Rocky Horror Picture Show. Well, not a monster, but you know what I mean. He creates a man. Yeah, the tone that you can go between horror and comedy and this over the top, but it feels so intentional. And then instead of being like a score could be way over the top, it just feels luscious instead of overkill. I love the sets as well. Could get back to the technicals. I just thought the sets were absolutely wonderful. It still has that really German expressionism influence that the first one had as well. He's pulling a lot of influence from Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Nosferatu by Murnau. And I love that look. And there's all these great canted angles. And instead of being overkill, it just seems delightful in its extremeness.
Well, movies like this are probably supposed to be taken as nightmares as well. So if they are more arch and over the top, and look like it's not real because it is a set and it's not actually outside. Or maybe it's outside in some cases, but a lot of this stuff clearly is a set. When the monster's wandering around graveyards and in the countryside, and that maybe works better because you've got those great backdrops. By the way, we watched the DVD that I've owned for many years. It's 1.37:1, so we saw the old Academy ratio, the square one, which of course looks weird now on the widescreen TVs. It's grainy as all hell, but the movie is so old, so you cut it that slack.
It looks better than some of the other old movies that we saw, the other prints that we've seen. They actually did a pretty good job of keeping it fresh. Getting back to the sets and the innovations, it got me thinking about something that we've talked about quite a bit, which is over the last decade, I mean, probably over the whole history of film, horror films is the place where the most interesting and innovative films are being made. Currently, a lot of credit goes to Blumhouse, but it's also this enduring trend. Horror films are the most daring and interesting movies. There's probably a few reasons for this. Mostly that fans of horror films tend to love the novel. They love to be surprised. They love something that pushes the envelope. So that's always going to encourage the filmmakers to take it to the next level and be braver in their choices. And also in the way no one takes horror seriously. Like you said earlier, they rarely get nominated for Academy Awards. They rarely get nominated for things like the AFI list. But it makes it commonplace for new directors to cut their teeth, places where people have visions and they just want to do whatever and they haven't been beaten down. This doesn't really apply to Bride of Frankenstein so much, but so many horror films are low budget. And then that again gives you an additional level of freedom, and you have studios like Blumhouse, Russ Meyer, of course, another great example, just someone who gives you very little money, but absolute freedom to do anything you want and encourages you to get out there.
Roger
and
Corman did an awful lot of horror films.
Yes,
probably more
yeah,
than
that's
that
right.
than
yeah,
anything
that's
else.
One. Yeah, yeah. It's a good business model and almost encourages people to take chances and do something brand new. And it's not the first example of horror being innovative because, like we just mentioned, all these great expressionist films from Germany, there is just something about this genre that encourages people to try things that are brand new, and then it becomes extremely influential on the rest of film.
Well, the Universal horror films around this time frame, like you said, the German stuff even before that, then you get into the 50s and 60s, and a lot of it becomes the boy next door killer, like in Psycho, or what's it called? Peeping Tom, I think is the one that influenced a lot of Hitchcock stuff. Then you get the supernatural horror in the 70s with The Omen and The Exorcist, and Rosemary's Baby a little bit before that. You get the slasher guys in the 80s and into the 90s. And
another innovation, a brand new thing when slasher films came
right.
out.
And as we've been saying for the last while now, especially whenever we cover one, for 5 to 10 years at least, it's the new age of horror. And so many of them are really good. We've covered a lot of the really good ones. The Witch and The Babadook and Get Out. It Follows.
Hereditary.
Hereditary, of course, too. And maybe we'll do Midsommar, which was Ari Aster's follow-up to that. There's so many great examples, maybe even us, by the way. And so many great examples of excellent horror films without even mentioning some of the more successful ones, like what James Wan has done with the Insidious films. And we did cover Saw.
Yeah, and horror,
and
the genre.
And found footage horror.
I was
going to
say, the whole genre was invented back in the late 90s with Blair Witch Project with found footage. That didn't exist before it was invented by a cheap horror movie made fast and dirty.
I don't know why this isn't respected, because much like comedy, this tends to be box office, and that's what they should be worshipping more than anything else. But they'd rather honor, as you said earlier, A Gone with the Wind, which I'm not a huge fan of. Okay, we've talked about James Whale already. His writers, and there were many adapters on this if you look online, but the actual screen credit goes to William Hurlbut, who was adapting Mary Shelley's 1816, or depending where you look, 1818 book. I'm not really sure. But the 18 teens is when she wrote it, a long time before they made the movie, well over 100 years before the 1931 version came out. And the producer was Carl Laemmle Jr., who worked on films we've covered, All Quiet on the Western Front, and he did produce the first Frankenstein picture. And the director, James Whale, I think we've already talked about him, Mr. Jimmy, according to Gods and Monsters, is what he was called by all the people that knew him.
Did All Quiet come out in the same year as this? 35?
1930.
Oh, 1930. Okay.
Won Best Picture, too.
All Quiet was another film where...
Fairly modern.
Yeah, it was a huge leap. I think the last one we would have seen before All Quiet was The General, 1928?
That was 27. So it was either that or Sunrise. I forget the exact order,
yeah,
but those
something
are the same
like that.
Year.
And then we watched All Quiet, and it felt like a massive country mile away from the films.
And then we started doing a lot of horror films. It was Frankenstein, and it was King Kong. City Lights was in there, too. That's not horror, but there was a stretch where we did those kinds of films, two or three of them, if not in a row, then in a short stretch after not doing any horror. And then we didn't do anything close to horror again forever. King Kong's not really horror either. It's like the Jaws, Silence of the Lambs thing on the original AFI list. Is it horror? Is it not?
Another notoriously innovative film.
Oh, yeah, and influential as all hell. What happens next? Well, obviously, Henry tries to bring a corpse back to life again.
He can't help himself.
Because he's a fucking asshole. He will never learn. Someone will say to him, I want to do this thing that's bad for everyone. No, no, I can't do that. But okay, fine, I will. You said, but I, so I must do it. Oh, I must wring my hands. What am I going to do? I'll just do it. I'll kill people. I'll be responsible for killing people. Not a fan of the guy. The actor does a decent job, but the character, I'm not criticizing anybody for this, but it's just frustrating with someone like that in a story like this gets away with everything. And no one points out, he's why all this happened in the first place.
You have to be able to buy it that somebody's urge to perform science is so great that they cannot resist it. And that he is a slave to his own need to pursue science.
Movies love showing as well when you mess with nature, when it comes back to haunt you, just like Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park may not be a Frankenstein adaptation. It maybe has more in common with King Kong, for example. But it is in some ways because they are messing with science, and quite a few of them die because John Hammond has to mess with science, and also somebody who gets away with it in the end.
With King Kong, it's greed, but with both Jurassic Park and Frankenstein, it's hubris. I think I agree with you. I think that it spiritually shares more with Frankenstein than it does with King Kong.
Jurassic Park does.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess that's it for Bride of Frankenstein. In 7 days, we'll be talking about another lady who beguiles her male co-star. We'll drive our Lotus badly back to 1990 and talk about Pretty Woman. The coming attractions trivia for Pretty Woman. And this is an opinion question rather than actually a trivia question, especially for the ladies. How much would it cost to get you to stay with a rich, sexy guy for a week in his posh hotel in Beverly Hills?
So... For the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Pretty Woman. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes of the Top 100 Project are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. And perhaps while you're there, in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis. Ellis Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you to Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. And that's all one word, top100project. And it's not case sensitive for a 20% discount.
Okay, a good podcast is worth repeating. So download this sucker and listen to it again.
And cut.